Hi everyone, and welcome to what I think is episode 6 of the Dunkin' and Dunkin' podcast. Apologies for the absence over the last few weeks, but I'm sure you understand it was out of our hands, but we're up and running now. I'm joined as always by my lovely co-host, the delightful Duncan Williams. Duncan, how are you doing?
Very well, Dunk. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And we're also very glad to be joined as well by JJ Hanrahan. JJ, thanks for joining us, man. How have you been?
Yeah, very good, lads. Great to get on and get a chat with you. Hope you're keeping well.
So we might as well just kick into starting by talking about what's going on at the moment. How are you finding the whole upheaval from being away from training, being away from playing and everything else?
Yeah, it's been strange. Like, it's the longest time I'd say I've ever had off. It's going to continue now as well, going into eight to nine weeks, and then we go back into preseason. So it's a strange time, really. You're kind of trying to balance it with kind of trying to enjoy it a little bit, but also you're kind of getting a bit, you get a bit rattled every now and again as well, because you're like, geez, am I getting unfit? Are we going to go back playing? What's going to happen? So it's just kind of that balance of trying to enjoy it every day and kind of a bit of relaxation, but also keep fit at the same time, you know?
Like, you all came in and divvied out the gear, bit of weights and stuff to each other, didn't you?
Yeah, to get like the, so a bit of a cardio equipment. So some lads got watt bikes, some lads got roars. And then if we were, it was grand for a while because we could run and we'd access pitches, but that's kind of slowing down now. So the kind of cardio equipment's coming in handy now, to be honest, because all pitches are pretty much closed now. It's hard to get access to anything, really.
Is UL completely shut down, like so?
Yeah, UL is completely shut down. You can't, I think there's only one or two maybe injured lads can go in and they have access to a pitch, and like they don't, there's no access to physios or anything like that. Okay. So they're on a list. You will have a gate that have it closed off, so you're on a list. Other than that, that's the only way you can get in, really. There's one park in Castletroy, public park. There's a bit of a kind of a old soccer pitch there. That's something I've kind of been using every now and again, to be honest.
I don't really understand why, say, like, publicly funded institutions aren't making their pitches available. Like, it's not their fault, like, but why they haven't been approached to make their playing fields available for public use for exercise. Say just schools or GA clubs or whatever.
Sure, if it's not within 2 kilometers of people's home.
But for, like, say, for people living within 2 kilometers, like, there's plenty of people living within 2 kilometers of a pitch, but
they're, I know, but they all turned up. This, like, to be too many people. It's like the car parks and all the walking places around here. All the cops are stopping people going in there, like.
Yeah, but I don't think they'd be overrun, and I think if people had somewhere to go, like, say, I was up in the People's Park yesterday, and there's a heap of people just up there kind of exercising on grass because they live in the city and they don't have gardens, and short of running out the road, there's actually
But you know, once the weather gets good, like, everyone's going to be out. You can see it already, like.
Yeah, well, yeah, I suppose, but I think it's something that could be considered, definitely. Like, I'd love to go up to, like, I live about 800 metres away from the Mary Eye pitches. I'd love to go up, and I've got rehab running that I probably should be doing for my hip, but I'm attempting quite poorly to run on the roads at the moment. Yeah. So I did a lap of the block there on Monday night. I think it was the first time I've gone for an actual run since June of last year. So I made it.
How long is the block, Doug?
It was 9:40, and that was more than enough.
I did 1,500 meters up the other day, and I was exhausted. I hadn't run for like 6 weeks.
Yeah, 6 weeks. That was like 10 months. Months for me.
We fitness testing last Friday, so.
Oh yeah, how did that work?
So basically, it was fair enough. Like, they just kind of give us it was all covered off. Essentially, you said, like, do your 1K time trial if you had 100 meter access. If you didn't, do your the shuttles, draw the black hole test, and then if you didn't have that, do a watt bike or do a burpee test. So, kind of just four things to do, really, and just like belt it out and just take a video of yourself doing it and just send it in, and that was it, really. Yeah, it was great.
How do they know if you've measured out the proper distance in the video?
I'd say they don't really care, to be honest. I'd say it's more just getting it done and just kind of like, yeah, you could take it 2 or 3 meters if you wanted to, but
you didn't seem surprised at that question, JJ. I'm worried. Were you?
Nah, because straight away, that's what we put in as well. Like, I had it on my watch though, so I have a proof. I had 1 kilometer exactly on my watch, so worked out well for me, thankfully.
It's funny, like, I'd say the levels of honesty would really become apparent when everyone comes back in, whenever that may be. I remember a few years ago, I won't name the player now, but we came back. So we used to have those tempo running sessions to do in the off season, where you'd be doing, like, they'd be kind of done by lengths of the pitch. Say, so you'd have 200 meters, 150, 100, that kind of real horrible high volume tempo running stuff, you know. So you'd be going on the minute. So, you know, you'd do the 200 and the goal would be 40 seconds, the 150 and 30, the 120. And you'd have, say, three sets of that to do, or three reps of that to do in a set. But I remember we were up in the bowl because it was around that time where, you know, it's the 2 weeks leading into the start of preseason when everyone's starting to filter back in and try and get themselves back into reasonable condition. Yeah, pretty much. There's a few of us up in the sports bar and we looked out and there was a player and he was running at max, it could have been 65 meters he was doing as his lengths of the pitch. And he came back up to like, what were you doing there? He said, oh, I was doing the session. So the session is 100 meter lengths, you know that. He said, oh, I asked the groundsman to measure out 100 meters for me, and that's pretty cool. the fella's professional to play rugby, like, he knows how long a rugby pitch is, or at least a ballpark figure for how long it is. Like, he was there plodding away through the 65 meter lengths instead of hundreds. He was happy out.
Yeah, the rest to get into Cork lads, and Archer was always a good man for the measurement, though.
Oh, yeah.
Was he, yeah?
Oh, yeah, because I was 95, like, 100-ish, like, do you know what he was doing?
100-ish.
The old tempo's there at the, before he went back to preseason. To be fair to then, he flayed in the 1K.
He was.
Archer's a Greek man for fitness, isn't he?
Yeah, some nimble man.
Yeah.
I'm to be honest, I'm quite glad that I'm not a professional athlete at this moment in time. Like, I know we can kind of laugh at it, but it must be pretty stressful, I would imagine, to be looking at this kind of length of time laid off and trying to keep yourself in shape. Like, as in, I was talking to a few people about this, and I reckon that a lot of people are going to struggle with breaking down with injuries when they go back in, because just that lack of stimulus of being on the pitch, moving in all those different directions, getting some sort of contact, even if it's not full contact, just on a regular basis, 2, 3, 4 times a week. There's literally nothing you can do to replicate anything like that at the moment. So I would just be worried that a lot of guys will come back in, and I know
what's
obviously
the story there. Like, say they decide that, right, games are going to happen. How long of a leading do you get? How long do you go back training before the game?
In terms of confirmation, I don't think it's confirmed exactly, but there's been talks that whenever it is announced that we're going to come back, now, as far as I'm aware, they want to try and finish the season, but that obviously is in line with whatever the government release. But they will be potentially, I think, is it a 4 to 6 week pre-season or a mini pre-season? Okay. To try and get lads back in shape, because there's been a lot of talk about that in the World Rugby. We've been talking about as well about player welfare coming back into, like, obviously when games are coming back in, that they can't just go, okay, you're ready to go next week, because there will be carnage injuries then, overload issues and stuff like that. So it'll take a while. So even when restrictions reduce, it'll still be a long time before a game is played, I'd say.
How will it work finishing the league? Do they play whatever finish the league, and then how long off do you get before you start the next season? Or just roll it?
Yeah. I don't actually, to be honest, I don't really know. I'd say whatever happens, if we are playing over summer, hopefully we would do end up playing and begin this season. I think they'll have to, because there's qualification for Europe and stuff.
I was wondering that as well. Like, is there, like, so at the moment, is it as it stands, if the top three of each conference or what? Or
yeah, I don't know. Like, imagine if you're in fourth position and you're 2 or 3 points behind someone, you'd be pretty angry.
Is there like the bigger teams kind of in fourth position there? Like, you know that?
I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't know. Whatever, yeah, you should surely know.
Yeah, I think I know that we're in second anyway, so that's where we need to be. But even for us to try and say, if it was to finish up the season, try and get a home semi-final, like, we obviously wouldn't get that opportunity if they decide to just go straight to finals or whatever. So we'll have to wait and see. We'll see how it goes and what happens. But I think if they do finish the season, it'll be a very short off-season in terms of a couple of weeks, like, and straight back into the beginning, I'd say.
Yeah, that's what in France now I saw they came up with two proposals yesterday. So the first is kind of if... So I think the French restrictions are in place at the moment until the 14th of May, and they're kind of, like, I think, optimistically thinking that if stuff with regard to sport lifts relatively quickly after that, they'll get stuck into the league again in June and go straight into the playoffs, and then kind of play the final stages over July and then start back in to the league at the normal time. But the contingency plan number two says if it's kicked off, or if sport is pushed back another bit, they're talking about, like, coming back more or less at the end of July, going straight into the final phases, with basically finals being played in kind of early to mid-August, but then starting the league again late August, start of September. And like, you could can you imagine going into a league like a French season like that, where you've got 32 games minimum, 32 competitive games minimum, plus your pre-seasons and everything else. And then if you're, or especially if you're coming out, if you do get promoted, I know they've obviously lost a lot of games now, but they're 16 teams in the second division of France, so you've got a lot of rugby being played across the entire season. So to go from that straight into a top 14 season again is just going to wreak havoc on players' bodies, I think.
Yeah, if you're getting promoted, trying to recruit, it's a be tough time right now for anyone doing that kind of thing.
I saw a man, Nick Abendon, is returning because he says because of this he can't get a club.
Is that right?
Yeah. Was he let go? Was he?
I think his contract was up, so he was looking to move on, or he wanted to play on, and there was rumours of going back to England, but because of obviously all the uncertainty of what's happening, he was kind of saying he looks like he's returning. Like,
okay. Right, yeah. So he's a contract up at in June in Claremont, is it?
Yeah, at the end of the season, like.
Oh yeah.
But there was a few lads in England were the same as well. I read a few articles over the last couple of weeks that were. They were kind of up in the air, didn't know what was going on because obviously their contracts were up. So, and then Leinster, obviously Rob Kearney's is up at the end of this year. Leinster came out and said that they pretty much got their squad sorted for next year. So I was like, are they telling them that there's not there or what? I don't know, but he was kind of saying he wanted to play on anyway. So obviously like him, at the end of his career would have been around this time here, got a chance to prove that he could still add something to Leinster, even though a lot of people have written him off. So it would have been a tough one for him to take as well, I'd imagine. Absolutely. If that is the case, obviously, I don't know if he's not getting something or not, obviously.
I feel for young guys in particular who are kind of chasing to find a contract at this time, they might have been let go from wherever that may be either in Ireland or England or elsewhere, and you're already up against it at that point if you're in a precarious position like that, and you'd be very much kind of low down the priority list of clubs that are looking to recruit as well at the moment. So fingers crossed most guys can get sorted and that they're not left in the lurch.
Will they go back to play the games behind closed doors, or will they only play them if crowds can attend?
I've no idea. I was chatting to my neighbour about it today, and he was asking me the same question, and I can't see, I don't know, this is with social distancing and stuff like that, how you can allow big crowds together. So will they play behind closed doors? I know NRL, Rugby League in Australia, did that for one or two rounds. They did it.
They're doing it in Las Vegas or something, where they all stay in the same hotel or something, isn't it?
Yeah, and then is it the Spanish League in basketball as well? They're going to the Balearic Islands, so was that a beat there or somewhere like that, where COVID cases are low, and they're all going to stay in hotels there, just the teams only. And I think they're going to play just with no crowds, just on TV, just to finish out their league. So, yeah, crazy stuff happening.
Crushed as an out half. So obviously, you have a level of skills that you need to ordinarily practice that are totally different to other people's. Like, so how does kicking or staying on top of your kicking come into a situation like this? Is there a way that you can keep on top of it, or
it was grand for a while. Like I said, when we had access to pitches and stuff. Now that's dying down. I actually got pretty lucky. So the crowd that I do a lot of my kicking stuff with, the School of Kicking in the UK, they have they've essentially a goalie net. They sit me over that. It's like a pop up net, and they put it in the backyard. And I don't think I've been in my yard before. It's pretty small now. It's like a postage stamp. So it's just more like technique stuff. Just practice that, which is great because you never miss. So you feel great about yourself, but at least you can get practice technique in a way, and kind of stay on top of that and left and right leg and keep going that way. But in terms of like a normal weekly routine that you get through, very, very different. And BJ Boat is actually good to us. He gave us a shadow ball. He gave all the Munster lads a shadow ball each. So we're just hopping him off the walls. I'd say my neighbours are going mad here in this tote every couple of days.
I think they're a great thing. If they were around when I was younger, I would have loved that.
Oh, imagine you're a kid. Yeah, you'd be absolutely delighted. When I was growing up, I used to spin the ball up in the air to myself. Imagine if you could actually get it back.
I used to let you pass it off the wall, sure, but bounce away from it in for about 10 minutes. Like, it was a disaster.
Yeah, just to explain what a shadow ball is, it's basically half a ball, so it's cut in half and the bottom of it is flat, so the idea is you can just throw it off a wall, it comes back to you. They're quite handy little things, all right? Yeah.
I'm surprised they're not more, like, that you don't see more kids with them actually around the place.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's kind of a thing.
It does quite well. I think in terms of orders and that kind of thing, it's done quite well over the last couple of years. I know they were kind of actually struggling to meet demand at one point, kind of when I was chatting to BJ a while back. So, and stuff like mental reps, JJ, does that form a big part of your day or your preparation at the moment?
I'll be honest, it would when I'm in a normal weekly routine. At the moment now, it's been very much just physical, because we are still a good few weeks away from playing, and I suppose the way I'm trying to see is kind of keep myself mentally fresh, because if we do go into that potential 15-month season, you don't want to be too exhausted either. So for me, it's very just physical reps at the moment with everything. And then kind of when I get back in or getting closer to the games, I get back into that mental side of it. And that's quite taxing as well. You know, it is quite heavy during the week. So I kind of
he's been mentally neck in battles of whiskey, Schlaf. And physically as well. That's the physical and mental parts he's doing to it.
It's like Dubai in my house. Weekends, it comes a day early.
I never appreciated a bank holiday until I started working. Jesus. The old shortened work week. Whoa, that's living.
Man, we never experienced in playing, do we? Like, not a hope. It's every week's the same. Bank holidays.
I would actually, I'd quite pay to see the first few sessions of handling drills when you all go back in, because I know coming back from the off season ordinarily, it literally like just chucking bags of sand all over the place for the first kind of week or so, and everyone's trying to switch their coordination back on, but that wouldn't have been after anywhere near as long of a layoff as you're experiencing now.
I know, yeah. We have, in fairness, like Larkin's given us kind of a skills challenge to do. It's quite hard, actually. It's like a 2-minute challenge between a tennis ball and a rugby ball. And again, just record yourself and send it in. And because we have like mini groups, and the best say person from each group, they come together, and whenever we get back, we'll compete. I don't know, for whatever prize, I don't even know what it'll be. But it's been pretty good. But I thought I was doing pretty well. I got like 2:40, and then I think Shane Daly got like 2:15 or something, so I blew everyone out of the water. So we've been kept going with little challenges and stuff to try and keep our skills up, but at the same time, you can't beat actually playing rugby, you know. It's very, very different.
And is there kind of communication, particularly with you as an out half, kind of between you and the coaching staff with regard to even just keeping sharp with regard to tactics and planning, that kind of thing? Or is it kind of a bit unrealistic to expect that kind of thing goes on at this moment in time?
I suppose just so far away, you know, you don't even know what you're prepping for. You're kind of,
and there's nothing that you can be watching, like, to take tips.
No, we don't even know where our next game is going to be, so we can't even analyze that. Or, you know, so you can preempt a few things. And I know the coaches are watching a few games, and they're trying to say finalize a certain type of way we want to play, come into good weather and stuff like that, and they're definitely talking about that kind of thing. But in terms of like what we're analyzing and stuff, there'll be nothing going on at the moment.
I used to love training this time of year now. The weather getting good, out in the sun training. Mm-hmm. It's hilarious. At this time of year, everyone's doing extras after training.
Don't be doing too well.
From like December till end of February, there's not a sinner out there doing it. Like, just the kickers and the odd fellas doing one or two things. Any bit of sun, everyone's out there.
So, Cross, just to rewind a little bit, you're from Kerry, obviously. No, you're from kind of a particular rugby stronghold in Kerry, Curragh, which a lot of Munster fans would be familiar with, but has produced a significant number of very successful rugby players over the year, particularly for a place its size. But overall, Kerry wouldn't be considered a rugby stronghold, with Gaelic football obviously being more or less a religion down there. So how was it that you came to be involved in rugby, first of all, and how was it that rugby was what appealed to you more so than Gaelic football, for example?
Yeah, football definitely was my first sport. I was definitely playing that from the age of 5 and 6, playing that first and for a couple of years. But then it was actually my next door neighbour, the Collinses, Des Collins, say would be Nora Collins' son. They, like, I used to go up to their house after school. They used to mind me and stuff, before my mom and dad come home from work. And he was man to rugby. He was about 16, maybe 15 at the time. And I was probably about maybe 8 or whatever. And he used to pretty much use me as his tackling practice. And that's how it all kind of started out. And I was like, and he used to always kind of say to me that I was pretty good at rugby, even at a young age. So he's like, you should give it a go. So I went in and I was pretty young, I'd say about maybe 7 or 8, and kind of got it stuck into that age. My mother gave me a scrum cap, shoulder pads, the whole lot going in, and gum shield. So I was actually put a prop, number one. When I first started, I was playing prop for the first couple of weeks. And then I slowly worked my way out of there, thankfully. And then I don't know, I just kind of fell in love with it straight away. It was I remember the time that I knew I was more of a rugby player than a footballer. Was I was playing football for the school after coming after rugby season, and a fellow was coming down the touchline, stolen the ball, and it just came out, and just for once I actually tackled a fella and low as well. And I just kind of totally forgot. I was like, oh God, what am I after doing here? Like, tackling him straight in the middle of a game. And I was like, sorry about that. And then so I was kind of like, yeah, football's not going to work out too much if they're here.
And what age did you keep playing football until?
16s, yeah. I played for like North Kerry under 16 and stuff, and went down to a few minor trials. But there was kind of at a time where I was just went to Rockwell at that time, and it was kind of difficult, and I kind of had to make a decision, and my dad was kind of pushed me to kind of make a decision as well. He kind of said, look, you can't be keeping, like, when I was younger, I would have played an awful lot of sport, like we're doing every night of the week doing something different. So he was very keen, and kind of like when I came to put 16, kind of like narrowing down the focus. And so then around 16, I was in Rockwell full time. It was too difficult coming down and stuff for training and things like that. So I kind of just focused fully on rugby then, and it kind of just took off from there, really, at about 16, yeah.
And kind of at what point, like you came to Rockwell in, did you do transition year in Rockwell, or did you go straight into fifth year?
Straight into fifth year, yeah.
Straight into fifth year, yeah. But you were, I remember you were straight into the starting side anyway, the senior cup team. I remember playing against you, and I remember you running right against us. I can't remember what... Yeah, I can't remember what round of the competition it was, but I remember because you were underage for Bowen Shield that year as well, weren't you?
Yeah, I played Bowen Shield that year as well. I think we got to the final or semi-final. We lost, and disappointed enough.
Yeah, because I remember us reading, and we were like, oh, this fella that was playing Bowen Shield, like, he's obviously a young fella, pure scrawny, like, and raw, and he'd be pure, like, lacking in confidence and everything else. So we trotted out.
That the curl gosh being there.
We were like, Where's the 16-year-old? Crush looked like the oldest fella on the team. Beard, receding hairline already.
Oh, I'm lucky. I'm that old, very young, you see. I haven't changed since. It's been grand. That's what I tell people. In there.
How did you find going into Rockwell? Did you know many people going in there? Or was it kind of...
I'll tell you, so Tom McGahey, you probably know him, Dunk, you probably both know him. He asked me to come or whatever, and I was real hesitant about it, being... as you call me, a muckshite from Kerry, Dunk. I didn't really know anything about private schools and stuff like that, and I wasn't even aware of schools rugby, just totally honest. I wasn't even aware of it. And I was straight away, I was like, I don't think I'll fit in up there. Like, that's not for me, whatever. I'll be grand. I'll go to club route and I'll be fine. And but I was going to kind of a Munster Youth's kind of skills thing above in Gary Owen, and the schools are there as well. And there was a good few Rockwell lads there. And Tom introduced me to all the Rockwell, as in Paddy Butler and a few more, Gav Ryan, Brian Smith. And I got on really well with them that day. And I was like, look, they're actually grand fellas. So that was kind of the changing point, really. And I kind of knew a few lads from that kind of Munster kind of scene before I went in there in front of as the rugby lads anyway. So that did help, in fairness. It was a good help going in there.
Did you find it a big step up when you moved into schools?
Yeah, oh man, I hadn't a clue what I was doing. Honestly, no. I remember we had these, it's sort of Crusaders drill, where you like go over and back the field, but then like he put two defenders in the middle of it, one of the coaches, and I was like, what's going on here? Like, I'd never, 16 years of age, I'd basically just catch the ball like in Castle Island, and we had a couple of good players outside me, so I'd give it to them or just do my own thing, you know what I mean? And slowly but surely, I heard about game management and figuring out how to balance the game and stuff, and so it took me a while settling, to be fair. But just the amount of rugby we had exposure to, like 3 or 4 times a week we were training. Mark Butler was my coach, who's involved in Munster now. Tom Mulcahy was there as well. So really good coaches as well at the time. And they just kind of, they really nourished me, to be honest, to get through. But when I first got in, I'm pretty sure I came off the pitch one of the days pretty much in tears, because I was like, I'm so bad at rugby, I don't even know what's going on. yeah, so it took a while to settle in terms of rugby, but I picked it up pretty quick, thankfully.
It's good to hear that the lads, like the coaches there, like make a big effort to make you feel welcome and stuff, you know, obviously coming in from Kerry and stuff, you know, even at that thing introduced, obviously they just wanted you to come to the school anyway because of what you could offer them, but like the fact he went away, got all the lads introduced themselves to you and sweetened the deal, I suppose.
He's
been a real like pivotal figure in a lot of lads' careers, really, hasn't he? Kind of guys who came through the club system, but guys who came through just the school system as well. He's just a brilliant kind of manager. I think he really manages to get the best out of people.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's Tom's biggest asset, is just like kind of one-on-one side of things, and I suppose getting you in the right frame of mind and getting the best out of you, really. Like, he's just kind of a fella that kind of just instills you with an unbelievable amount of confidence. Even today, like, you know, even if you're feeling a bit down yourself after a game, you give Tom a ring and you'd be walking on a cloud nine after it, so... It's still the same thing today, you know what I mean? You just feel as well as an unbelievable amount of confidence. But so I think, like myself, Paddy Butler, he had a good impact on Paddy. Dave Foley, Tommy O'Donnell, he's involved with all them lads, you know, coming through. So there's been a good few fellas who've been involved, in fairness.
That's what you need, though, at that kind of age. Like, it's the fellas who just kind of make you enjoy your rugby, as opposed to, like, you know, you get so bogged down in things when you don't play well and stuff. You kind of, when you become professional, but when you're younger, like, you know, you play it for fun. It's what you love to do, you play it because all your friends played it and you want to like win things with them and stuff, and it just, you get so diluted and people forget about it, like when obviously pressurized situations, pressure rugby is like. But it's just, I just love playing school, and just even looking back at now, it's like my younger days was like my favorite time to play rugby, like, because just such great fun. You're playing with all your school friends, fellas you've known for years, you're going out winning matches with them, and just I thought it was a great thing.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree, and I've definitely fallen into that trap as well, Dunk, where you put so much pressure on yourself, you think that it's now or never, and the game of rugby is not the game that you started playing for because you loved it growing up as a kid. It's a totally different thing you're playing for, and then it's not, you're not getting the best out of yourself, you know what I mean? That's what I found anyway, and quite trying to go back to that kind of playing your natural instinct with all the skills you developed throughout the year is probably the way I've found it has helped me the best to develop, whereas when you go into that cycle of where you're just putting unbelievable pressure on yourself, it's like, I've been there. It's like, it's horrible enough place to
I was also jealous of Zeeves. Like, he never lost that. Like, he always just, it was still like he was in school playing for the fun of it. Like, it was unbelievable. To be fair to me, I was at a smileless face. No, he was shit hot as well, which helped. Like, but it was, I think that contributed to why he was so good in such big occasions, that he was just, Joe played with a smile on his face, didn't let things get him down. He just enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah, he was unbelievable for that, and he still is. You know, what I mean, that's what, he's a buzzer. Like, he lives his life like that. You know, and I think that all that stuff comes from like an unbelievable amount of internal self confidence as well. Like, Zeebs is kind of just, no matter what the occasion is, like, he completely backs himself no matter what. And I think we could all do with a bit of that, to be honest.
Yeah. So, like, you broke on very quickly after school as well, Chris. Like, I think you were on your 6th-year holiday and you arrived into pre-season training kind of obviously a couple of weeks later, because you'd just done the leaving cert or whatever. I remember you breaking the line 3 or 4 times in the first 10 minutes of the drill, and everyone going, oh, Jesus, who's this? But like, you kind of progressed through the ranks very quickly. You obviously had that outstanding Junior World Cup campaign where you were nominated for Junior World Player of the Year, and then you kind of broke on with Munster very shortly after that. So how did you find kind of being that young guy who there was a lot of hype about and who everyone's talking about as the next big thing? Did it get into your head? Was it ever difficult to deal with, or did you just take it all in your stride, do you think?
No, at the time I was aware of it. Like, I was aware of people talking, and I knew, like, the people were saying, oh, you're just a good opportunity, if you're going well here, things like that. But I was kind of like probably taking on my stride at the time. I actually found it harder, say, like, when I was got to put 21, 22, when I kind of, like, in my head, like, I hadn't lived up to the hype myself, you know what I mean? But, like, it was fine from 18 to, like, 21, 22. But then, like, after that, I was like, well, I'm actually still not starting. I'm still not the person people are saying I'm potentially going to be or whatever. And but I was probably mentally away off it, you know what I mean? In terms of what it takes to become a weekly starter and the amount of work you have to do off the field, the mental side of the game. We're still I probably don't know if I've changed much now, but I was a small, fat, chubby kid that relied on my talent, you know what I mean? And let's call a spade. And I remember Paul O'Connell said to me a couple of years back, I was probably about 21, and he said, like, are you ready to play 21 games in a row? I was like, yeah, pretty sure I'm ready to play 21 games in a row, you know, like, young and brash. And I think when I was in Northampton, I played 10 in a row, and I was absolutely mentally and physically broke after playing 10. And he's like, talking about playing 21. And so, like, you've it kind of gives you an understanding of what it takes to go into, if you want to be that top professional and play week in, week out, and always turn up. It takes an awful lot mentally and physically, you know what I mean? So
is that pretty much the reason why you looked at moving to Northampton to become first choice starting 10 week in, week out? I know you played a bit of 12 over there as well, but was that the main goal, over there to go over and play 10 and just be an out and out 10?
That was definitely the goal, 100%, to be an out-and-out 10. Because I was playing, even when I was at Munster at the time, I was playing a bit of 10, I think I played a lot of 12, playing a bit of fullback as well, and I felt like I was just getting a bit, I suppose I was impatient, I felt like I was kind of losing my way a bit, I was kind of adamant, I'm a 10, I'll get where I need to be. So kind of, if I had maybe, looking back, a bit more patience, it might have helped as well, but I wouldn't change any of my decisions, you know what I mean? I went over there, learned an awful lot about myself, learned an awful lot about rugby in general. Oh, he's Dunk.
And that breastfeeding, in case you're wondering.
Yeah, so it was a good experience overall.
Yeah. No, I suppose a lot of people were kind of shocked when you did decide to leave, but to be fair to you, you backed yourself and you went, and you obviously you were young enough to come back at some point as well, so it wasn't like you were...
Yeah, I agree. I had that on my side. No, I was very aware, and a few people listened to me.
Congratulations, first and foremost. You might introduce the new arrival to
Oh, yeah, this is a little Mia. I think she has after developing a bit of colic, so she's not very good in the evening. If I set her up right, she might be too bad, but there now. Say hello to the lads. She refuses to keep the dummy in. She's like your dad, spit the dummy in. Things aren't going well.
Okay,
we could be all right. Yeah, she's not settling down.
Yeah, how? Or, sorry, where were you on about? Just talking about moving over to be an out and out 10, or to cement yourself as a 10.
Yeah, just trying to get as much game time as I could in that position. You know what I mean? Because I hadn't played an awful lot of rugby at 10 in Munster before I left, and it was more so about just trying to get as much exposure to rugby at the top flight. That was my main focus really, and just challenge myself. And at the time, Northampton were going unbelievably well as well. I think they'd won the Premiership, gone to the Premiership final. And then I often joke, lads, I turned up in the catalyst for the downturn.
Just there, how did it go down when you were, obviously, you played a good bit of 12 there. How did that kind of sit with you? Were you like, oh, here we go again now? Not picking one position in particular and kind of jumping between two.
Yeah, so the first season I was there, I played a good bit of 10 that year and came off the bench quite a bit of 10 as well, between myself and Myler. And then the second year, I broke my leg in pre-season against Ulster, actually. So I missed the start of the season. And then the week I was due back playing, Harry Malander was playing 12, and then he got injured. He did his ankle. So then there was no 12 available, and I was coming back the next week. So they put me straight into 12. And then that's when I went into that 10 game straight then at 12. So myself and Stephen were playing 10-12, and they kind of wanted to play a different style of rugby, so it kind of suited what we're trying to do at the time as well. Kind of two ball players, 10-12, and we'd Luther Brella 13 or George Peasy, so it worked out well. But then literally 10 games in, I played Montpellier away and I broke my thumb.
So, I was watching that game actually. We were watching that in Limerick.
Yeah, so that explains what happened to Nandolo in that game. I mean, his highlights really. People like my mates from home keep sending it to me. Never get ahead of yourself with your mates from home, that's for sure.
I remember being one of the Georgian lads in France who couldn't speak any English, coming over to me really excitedly one morning, and then bringing me over to his gear bag. He took out his phone. It was a bloopers video at that time. I threw the ball off back of Paulie's elbow over the terrace.
Back of his head.
No, it was his elbow.
We'll ask his opinion.
Make sure he has a very solid opinion on that now.
What was it like going over at that age, Crush? Because you were still very young at that point. Like, I think we lose track because you always looked kind of 30 or older. We kind of lose sight of the fact that you were actually very young around that time. What age were you when you left?
I was 22. I turned up a preseason at 22. Jeez. Over there. Moved into a house with three lads, and they were kind of looking at me going like, what are you going to bring to the club? You know what I mean? I was like, I'm hoping to be taught. You know what I mean? I think that was the biggest mistake I probably made going over was, I think they were looking for the finished article in terms of like, they wanted me to just go in, perform and execute straight away. And I was kind of at the mindset of like, oh, they're going to teach me along the way. And, so you think that'd be pretty straightforward. That'd be sound out before we went. But it was kind of, I suppose, that kind of lack of communication or maybe a miscommunication that happened. And I took me a while to settle in, you know what I mean? Just settling into the into a new country, like being away from all your friends, stuff like that, trying to get comfortable around the squad because, I don't know, like, I've kind of, you figured out, like, I'm not unbelievably loud person in the dressing room, so when I'm comfortable around lads, I chat away, but, like, I'm quite shy around people I don't know, so it took me a while to kind of get to know lads very well in the group, and I think that definitely affects the way you kind of play and interact with lads in the field as well, when you're not that close to them. So once I kind of settle in that way with that, it was probably maybe after 4 or 5 months, before I really felt comfortable within the group, really, that was good, in fairness. But I remember, like, one of my first meetings, when I got my first cap, they do this thing where you present you a tweed jacket, and
you already had your own Richard from your own fashion sense, like.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so they gave me the tweed jacket, and then one of the lads, they're like, oh, I was like, what do I have to do? And they're like, oh, everyone sings, you have to sing. And I was forced up, of course, so I sung an Irish song. And they were roaring, laughing. No one ever sings. Everyone just does an old little speech or whatever. And I was up there at the top of the room, belting out Irish songs in front of a lot of English lads. They're probably looking at me going, like, what is this for that? Like, but that kind of broke the ice, to fairness, for the best thing that could have happened.
Yeah, I think, like, and it's only something that I got an appreciation for when I went away myself. But and it kind of nearly, And it made me feel bad about the foreign lads that had come to Munster previously. Not that we weren't inclusive of them or anything else, but like it is such a shock to the system to leave. And I mean, I was 27 when I left, and you were 22. And like I found it an incredibly hard adjustment. And I think that's overlooked, as the focus is always on integrating people into the rugby system, but really that can't come until the person is comfortable in their environment. And that's not just within the club off the field, but it's outside of the club as well. You know, someone's going home and kind of staring at the four walls of their apartment or their house, and they're living in the middle of nowhere, or they don't know anyone around, and they're just totally away from all the good habits that they would have had at home. It's impossible to expect them to slot into well into the rugby side of things once they actually get into the club.
Had they someone particular in the club that is in charge of doing that for new lads?
Yeah, so Paul Shields now, who's the manager's time, he's from Ulster. Paul Shields, Ulster lad, he was over there for a long time. So he would have, like, even when I went over, before I got over there, he would have had a map printed out for me with like a couple of hotspots where lads live. He had two houses ready for me to go. One of them was an apartment with someone else. One of them was my own house. And sorry, three houses. And the third house was the farmhouse I ended up living in with lads, like probably 10 minutes outside Northampton. And so like I had all that stuff laid out ready to go and going over there, which was a massive help. And someone collected me, the kit man collected me from the airport when I turned up, and drove me to the house. And then they had a club car for me for a couple of days, but then they actually had to take that car back. So I had no car for a while. So I was bumming lips for a while. And then it was actually Dylan Hartley sorting me out. He was sponsored by a group called Vindus. And he got one of their workers to come and collect me and bring me down to a car garage and sort me out with kind of a deal, getting a car over there. So he was kind of the first probably fella as captain of the club as well, who stepped up straight away and was just like, here you go, like, what can I do for you? And he was unbelievably sound, in fairness.
That's good to hear.
When it came to deciding to come back, obviously, look, you kind of ticked all the boxes in the way open that everything went according to plan. You know, you were playing for your home province. You broke in early. You were involved in really big results and everything else. But then, obviously, there came a point where it was in your interest to head abroad to somewhere different in order to kickstart your or to kick on your career. So, like, was the plan always to come back, or at what point did it become a genuine option for you?
I definitely wanted to come back 100%, because I went away with the idea that I was young enough to go and learn, and hopefully the opportunity, if I kept progressing, would be there to come home. Now, it probably came a little bit sooner than I thought. Rassi actually got in contact with me probably about a year and a half in, and asked me to come home. And so that was probably, it was perfect timing for me as well, to be honest. I probably, my second year at Northampton was very tough. I had an awful lot of injuries, three surgeries and stuff. So I was probably in a tough place being away from home, and all that stuff's happened as well. So it was kind of a perfect timing, and it worked out well. And I was kind of coming to the age around 25, 26. I was like, I need to start kicking on here now, back at home in Ireland, if I want to try and push on a bit to something else. And so that's kind of where that came about, really. Rassi kind of got on the phone, and thankfully it worked out.
So was it Rassi himself actually rang you about come back, was it?
Yeah, Rassi himself, yeah. It was. I'd never met Rassi before, so never met a person that was so straight and direct down the phone in my life. So I was a little bit taken back by him. I was like, what do I say here? But yeah, he was pretty good. Yeah, he was in contact quite regularly, just different conversations. And with Jonesy as well, Felix had a big part to play in as well. So I was chatting to him quite a bit about the whole move as well. So no, it was good. It was a good move.
What's that like coming back to your home team after being away for a couple of years? Because it's in Munster, and I think in most of the Irish provinces, it doesn't happen too often where someone moves away and then ends up coming back, particularly if they move kind of to another country, they rarely end up coming back. So how did you find that? Was there kind of, I know people talk about repatriation actually being almost as problematic as when you immigrate the first time, and that obviously that's a massive shock to the system, and the guys can be homesick, and then they just have this completely inaccurate an idealistic view or idyllic view of what life at home is like. So you expect it just to be brilliant as soon as you get back, and then you come back and there's actually a huge challenge to readjust into the pace of life back at home, and things aren't exactly as they were when you left them, even though in your head that they still are. So how did you find that?
Yeah, it was pretty accurate, man, to be honest, unbelievably accurate. So I came back as well with a busted up shoulder, so I was in the middle of rehab. So I came back and I couldn't even train with the group. I was just kind of in the physio room rehabbing my shoulder after getting reconstruction. So I was like, they were obviously out in the physio, out in the pitch, cracking on, kind of building camaraderie as you do in preseason. And I was there in the physio bed and kind of trying to catch glimpses of them in the change rooms where I could, you know. So it's kind of on my own for quite a bit, coming back into it straight away. And that was definitely a tough part. Now, I had good mates in the group as well. You were there and stuff. And it was lads I knew well from playing when I was younger. But I'd be honest with you, like, my kind of initial feeling was like, I was like kind of one of like, geez, I feel almost a little bit on the outskirts of the squad, even though I've played for this club before, you know what I mean? So I still probably even took, I suppose, until I came back and played my first game, which was, when was that? It was probably maybe just around maybe November, October. I think I played in that Cardiff game. It was my first game back. It was like maybe 5-6 games into the league when I came back from my shoulder. It was kind of around that stage where I kind of felt like I was fitting back into the group again when I actually started playing. But the first couple of months there, particularly rehabbing, was quite tough, to be honest.
Yeah, it's kind of it's an interesting thing because, as I said, not a lot of people have done it, and it kind of, it's something that nobody even really considers. I think like everyone's just like, oh, that's JJ, but he's been here before. He knows how it all is already at this point. Like,
no, it makes difference. Younger lads have come through, lads that were playing obviously a lot more now, and the kind of dynamics of the group had changed, a couple of older fellas had gone, and it was just, you know, just kind of trying to figure out your line, you know, there's like a squad dynamic within a massive group, and you're kind of...
We were all in Limerick then as well, wasn't it? Was that our first year?
Yeah, and that was the first year in, and there was no travel anymore, and it was just very, very different, man. It was totally different, to be honest.
Did you find it hard to impose yourself as a 10, again, coming back in, say, the way you would have been before? Or was it very much pick up where you left off a couple of years earlier?
How do you mean by that? Sorry, in the game plan?
In terms of game plan, or just kind of as a voice, as a tactical voice, or as a leader in the group, was it difficult coming back at the second time?
Definitely, because I think like the lads were like a year down the line. I think he had Rassi and Jock for about a year at this stage. You need a good grasp on what they were trying to do, and in terms of like game plan and stuff like that. So, you know, when Rassi was there, he's such a strong voice, you know what I mean, that there wasn't a whole lot of kind of, I suppose, imposing yourself you have to do. He was kind of the most imposing figure in the room, and he kind of did that all the time. So I suppose...
Was it like that in Northampton as well, or...?
Yeah, I suppose Dylan Hartley was probably the most important figure there. Like, it was pretty much like Dylan was the main man in terms of what he says, kind of went, you know what I mean? And and Jim as well. Jim Malner had a big say as well, in fairness. Them two lads pretty much ran the show there, you know what I mean?
Are they very approachable, the two lads?
Jim and Dylan was. Yeah, they were very, very approachable now, in fairness. Yeah, they were good. But in terms of like with Rassi and how I was dealing with him, like, I'd probably just never seen anyone operate the way he was operating at the time. You know what I mean? So I was kind of just like, almost sit back here. You know, I suppose that was probably a mistake I made, was not probably imposing myself enough in the group, and probably didn't have enough of that confidence to kind of start leading from the front straight away. And that probably came back to bite me a little bit in that first year. You know what I mean?
You mentioned about getting to a point where you're putting too much pressure on yourself and how that affects your overall approach, not just the game, but I think to outside the game as well. What kind of journey have you been on with regard to that? You said you're more relaxed now than you maybe would have been a couple of years previously. How have you found that progression, or is that just something that sorts itself out, or is it something you've had to work on specifically?
Definitely had to work on it, man. Like really, really, really had to work on it. For me, as an individual anyway, it was pretty simple. Don't be honest, hit rock bottom when I got drafted at European quarterfinal last year. It was probably like I've been not picked for Munster games before, but that was probably my first time where I felt like I was like really dropped, you know what I mean? Like, it was a big game and I wasn't selected. Like, I've always kind of been in a position where I'm like on the bench or maybe starting, you know what I mean? Whereas this time I was like, okay, I'm completely out of the squad. I'm not even within an arse's roar of the place, you know what I mean? So that was kind of like rock bottom for me. And I was kind of going into that game thinking it might be my 100th game. And then I was like, I need to... Essentially, I wasn't playing the way I knew I could. I remember that Zebra game I played the week before. I'm pretty sure I played the worst game of rugby I've ever played in my life in that game. I remember I was like kicking balls into fellas' legs and stuff, and I was like, what am I doing? I was 5 minutes off from the try line. I tried to grubber a ball through, and I was coming off the field going like, that is quite simply the worst game of rugby I've even watched someone play. Not a mind to actually be the person that's done it. So to play that kind of game of rugby at that level, you're kind of going, oh my God. So I had a good sit down with the missus after that and a good chat through things about. And in fairness, James Cronin brought me for a coffee as well and just kind of said, like, he's like, you're just not playing the way you play rugby anymore. You're not playing as yourself. And I would have had regular contact with Bomber as well around the mental side of the game. So kind of from that point on, just kind of went back to where I spoke with Dunk earlier on in the podcast about kind of just kind of going back to what your instinct is and playing with enjoyment and stuff, and going back and trying to remember why you started playing rugby. And then throughout the years of all the experience you gained, that'll automatically come into the game. You know what I mean? Rather than trying to force it and think about it and, oh, should I kick this, or what should I do in this scenario? Just play. And then inevitably, you, seven times out of ten, you get the decision making right, because you're getting more into flow as opposed to thinking, you know?
Yeah, but I think particularly a guy like you, because your, like, your strength was always playing off the cuff, like right from, like, right back in school, it was just, it was almost that second nature kind of way of attacking the line, or stepping off your outside foot, paw into the chest kind of thing. There was kind of never any doubt that there was massive ability there, but it's just interesting to see how kind of the mentality of things can dictate how you go out in the field and approach stuff. But you've obviously, you're coming off the back, or, well, maybe the season isn't done and dusted yet, but you're kind of in the middle of, we'll say, a hugely positive season for you. How important has that been to have that really good, like, long, consistent run of really good performances this season?
Massive, yeah. Like, just more for a personal point of view, just to know that, like, yeah, you can actually still do something here. You know what I mean? Because it's been a long time coming for myself as an individual, not a mind for everyone else that supports me, to try and put that run of games together and to try and play at some bit of a decent level. There's been a few hiccups along the way as well, but I suppose the situation we're in, maybe fortunate for me and unfortunate for others, is that there's been not many other people around to play at number 10 this year. So I've had a good bit of opportunity to keep kind of righting your wrongs and making games and stuff and get that chance.
That's half the battle. If, like, fellas get injured and you're fit, that's it. That's your chance to get, like, 10, 11, 12 games in a row on the bounce. Like, and that's, like, if anyone gets that many games in a row, you'd be surprised what they can do. Like, it's hard. Yeah. In one game, out another game, in the next game, or you're on for 20 minutes, you're out for next week, you're on for 40 minutes or 50 minutes. It's impossible to get any bit of consistency. You need, like, 7, 8 games. People think, oh, he's played 2 or 3 games now in a bounce and he hasn't played unbelievably well. But it's like, you're still getting your match fitness at that point. It's just, I think it plays a massive, massive role in people maximizing their potential, is that getting that run of games. It's not like 4 or 5, it needs to be like 8, 9, 10 games.
I agree. And it's kind of get confidence as well. And then you go through, like, every game is a different game. Some games are loose, some games are really tight, you have to manage them. And once you go through that, like, kind of 8, 10 games, you've gone through a lot of different types of games as well. And you might have to close out a game, you might have to try and win something at the death.
Yeah.
Like, when you, as in our position, Dunk, like 9s and 10s, when you haven't been in that scenario regularly enough, it makes it very, very difficult. But all of a sudden you get 10, 12 games and you've done it in your, or 3 games ago, I remember this scenario because we had to, 60 minutes in, we were 2 points ahead and we had to do this, or, you know what I mean? And it just kind of rings a bell. Whereas
it becomes autopilot as opposed to having to think about it. Like, it's just...
Yeah, exactly. And then performance start happening and people go, oh, that fella can play. You know what I mean? And it just takes, but it's like...
He's not shit after all.
Yeah, so that's been a good season. I just hopefully it goes back on and we can get back onto playing again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I just think that was the injuries was, as I said, my best season always came when there were so many injuries that I played. I nearly had to play every single game of the season, so just gave me that chance to get that level of consistency. You know, as I said, you get your match fitness, and then the rest falls into place. It's hard to get once you're only in and out every second week, like.
You kind of had a complete role reversal. Your younger career was a lot of injuries, and then pretty much, I'm right in saying, for the last 5 years of your career, you probably didn't get injured, did you?
Yeah, I think I went like 7 years without not being available for a match.
Yeah.
No, I didn't get picked every week, but I was available.
Every week. Yeah,
that's it. That contributed to the amount of games that I did get over the years. Like, as I said, I would only had relatively low number of caps till I was 25 or 6. I got the majority of mine in kind of 27 to 33, like, so it was, as I said, I was just there, I was last man standing a lot of time, and I had to play. I'm not, like, if there was others there, I don't know what they've been picked, but a lot of time I was last man standing, and so there was no one else to play, and I got my run of games through that, like, and so I think you really get the chance to show people, like, what you can do when you do get those run of games.
I agree. I think as coaches as well, I think it just gives them a... Sometimes when they have no choice, they kind of like they have to put you in. That, like, it's just.
I always said there's two different approaches. One coach would be like, "Oh shit, everyone's injured, we're down to this fella," and then the other coach is like, "Who's it? He's injured. Next man in. Don't care who it is." And just the difference in the confidence that you get from those two approaches, like, do you know what I mean? like Murray, like obviously Murray was in my position, so when he got injured, I benefited from that a lot of time. But some coaches, you could see that they were panicking straight away. They were like, oh no, he's out. Like, this is going to be an absolute fucking mountain to climb here. Whereas another coach was like, yeah, I don't care who he is, he's out, next man in, and I've no doubt he'll do the job. And in his own mind, he mightn't have thought that I was up to it or whatever, but the fact that he gave me the confidence to think that Joe was just next man in and that the quality wasn't going to change, it was just a difference that makes to my own mentality and the way I approach the games and the performances, I think it was just massive.
Definitely agree with that, yeah.
Just, I suppose, just finishing up, Crushed, kind of moving away from rugby, what kind of pursuits are you engaged with at the moment, or do you have any kind of long-term projects outside of rugby that you're involved in at the moment? You're always kind of one of the more interesting guys to spend time with when I was still gainfully employed by Munster, and since as well, since I've come back to Ireland. So.
Pursuits? Yeah, what are you talking about, Duncan? You talking about university or talking about something different, like along the lines of that, or
whiskey?
Just, yeah, kind of what you keep yourself busy with outside of rugby, or kind of what you see yourself doing when rugby finishes up. Is there anything you've identified?
Not a whole lot. I was in New York recently enough, and I met up with a few guys and just kind of chatted and around, because I'm getting 27 now, you know what I mean? I'm trying to think like, okay, hopefully play for as long as I can, but whenever that day comes, I'm trying to want to make the seamless transition. For a while, I was kind of looking at university. Will I go back now and do a master's, or well, I'll do the Enagle route. I might finish when I finish that year, use that year out, and just go straight into an MBA, try and do a high quality MBA in some university. So I'm kind of looking at different routes like that. And then I met a guy in New York, and he kind of advised me against the MBA. So you probably need more experience before you start going doing that. So yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of just trying to like chat to different people, trying to find avenues where to go to next. Marcus Horn's been good help now at the moment, to be fair.
I found it to be very good as well when I was finishing up in the last year as well.
Yeah, he's great. Like, everything you approach him with, it's just like, I sent him a long email the last day about some of my interests around, like, I want to try and just looking at some like management courses potentially to go back and do. And I know there's one in UL, but just when you enter something, you want to be able to make sure you can give it a good go as well, because it's some of them university masters are quite heavy going, you know what I mean? And if they're full time as well and not part time or online, it can make it quite difficult. So he's just been looking at alternative options, and he's been a great help, to be fair. So that's probably the next focus, really, is trying to get back into some sort of education. And I'm probably looking at that right now while we have time and downtime, and probably scrolling the internet quite a lot. Just trying to see do things match up. But on a more of a relaxed note, then there's been a lot of, which Duncan Williams is not too happy to see, a lot of barbecuing.
I love seeing the barbecues, but.
Yeah, a lot of barbecue, a bit of bacon, a bit of sourdough making, and that's been a bit of gardening. Not Peter Man.
Bread is all the rage, isn't it?
Bread is all the rage, yeah. It's hard going, man. It's a science and an art. It's a science and an art. It's tough.
I made some banana bread myself the other day.
Did you post it online? It doesn't really happen unless you post it online, seemingly.
I don't post those things online. I'm definitely going to get grief if I post banana bread online.
I saw something recently. It's just like, it's pretty much one of the bosses. Literally everyone in the country at this point is make banana bread and post it online.
It was trying to get my son to eat, because he's on hunger strike at the moment with this fucking lockdown. And the new baby arriving, he seems to have taken umbrage to everything. So it was, little did I realize now, it was the amount of sugar that goes into banana bread. It wasn't a healthy one, so he lied to himself.
He didn't lick it off a stone.
Yeah,
all right, lads. I'd say that's enough. JJ, thanks very much for joining us.
Great chat,
productive, and the very best of luck for the rest of the season, if there is a rest of the season. And Dunk, good to see you, and nice to meet you.
She's waving there too.
See you, lads.